In the 17th century, the Dutch city of Delft was at the center of a scientific and artistic revolution that historian-philosopher Laura J. Snyder says changed how we look at the world. Her new book, called The Eye of the Beholder, Johannes Vermeer, Antoni van Leeuwenhoek, and The Reinvention of Seeing, looks at these changes through the stories of these famous citizens of Delft, the painter Vermeer and the father of microbiology, van Leeuwenhoek. Laura Snyder is a professor at St. John's University. Her book is published by W.W. Norton. I'm very pleased to welcome her to our show today. Hello.
Hello, I'm delighted to be here.
You write that Vermeer and van Leeuwenhoek were both baptized in Delft during the same week.
They were.
1632, and as adults, they lived and worked just a few blocks from each other. And throughout the book, you interweave their stories with enticing ideas of ways their paths might have crossed, but we have no idea whether they did.
There's no smoking gun. When I started research for the book, I was hoping I would find some bit of definitive evidence, but there is none. Of course, if they did know each other, there would have been no reason for letters between them because they lived so close together. But there is a web that intertwines them.
Well, they were both prominent in their field, so what I would assume that they would have attended some social functions in a city that is the size of Delft, and I guess it had around 20,000 inhabitants at the time.
It did, and they both held positions in the government. Leeuwenhoek was the chamberlain of the city council, and Vermeer twice served as the headman of the Artists Guild, the Guild of St. Luke's.
Would they have been considered members of the same social group, social
class? I think so. And also, the town was so small, 20,000, as you said. They were exact contemporaries. If you think how many people lived in Delft who were exactly the same age, male, and with some education and interests in lenses, there couldn't have been that many.
Was Delft considered small at the time? Because today it's not even one of the 10 largest cities in the Netherlands.
It was medium-sized at the time. You know, when you go there today and stand in the center of the market square, you realize, though, how small it really is. It's about the size of an American football field. And these two men, Vermeer and van Leeuwenhoek, lived on opposite sides of the square and worked around the square for their whole lives. And you could only imagine they must have been passing each other many times a day.
Was Delft considered a major city, or because of its association with the Dutch royal family, the House of Orange now?
It was very close to The Hague, so it did have a close association with the royal family, or the leaders of the state, the stadtholder. As well, they were a big brewing town, so they were quite known, quite important for making beer. And they also, of course, had the big pottery works. In addition, they were known as a major glass-making town. So they were making the best glass in all of the Netherlands and in much of Europe as well.
And Delft, China, is still considered some of the greatest ever.
Yes,
are they still
is.
Making it today?
They are.
Vermeer's father was an innkeeper and an art dealer. Did he encourage his son to become an artist?
Well, he must have allowed him to.
We don't know
apprentice.
A lot about either of these people.
We do not. For Vermeer, there's almost no documentary evidence. There's his birth certificate, his death certificate. There are some documents in the archives related to his estate and how it was dealt with after he died. By the way, Leeuwenhoek was the executor of his estate. So that's the only place in the documents besides the record of their baptisms that they appear together. But we can make inferences, historical inferences. We know that Vermeer registered with the Guild of St. Luke's as an artist, and we know he must have then apprenticed with some master painter, because that was a requirement of the guild, and they were very strict about their rules.
Now, you mentioned that Leeuwenhoek was the executor of the estate. Would he have done that because he knew Vermeer, or simply because that was his job?
That's the $64,000 question, really. One would think they must have known each other, and many people do think that. The social historian Michael Montius, who did much digging in the archives and found all the documents related to Vermeer and then translated them and published them, which was wonderful for me, he feels that it was just part of Leeuwenhoek's job in the city government. However, during the time he was in the city government, over 50 years, years, something like 15,000 people died in Delft. And Leeuwenhoek served as the executor of only three estates. And I dug around a little more, and I found that he either knew the person or was very familiar with the property of the people in each of those other three cases.
It's interesting that both of these men made their livings from other things other than what they had become famous for. Was Vermeer more successful as an art dealer or as a painter during his lifetime?
He was successful as an art dealer. He was known outside of Delft as a painter, so he was clearly selling paintings. I think in his day he was well-known and well-regarded. There is evidence of that, people writing about him. One of the poets of the time, or writers of the time, Blazewick, referred to him as the phoenix rising out of the ashes of Karel Fabricius, the student of Rembrandt's who was killed tragically in the blast of the munitions dump. So people did know about Vermeer as a painter as well.
That famous blast, was Fabricius the only person? He was a very great artist, I thought, but was he the most important person to have died in that blast?
Many hundreds of people died in that blast, and I don't think historians know exactly how many. He certainly was one of the more famous people who died.
Do we know what van Leeuwenhoek's early life was like?
We do. We know he lost his father when he was young, and his mother remarried a painter who also had two sons who were painters. So that's
another small world.
It's another connection.
But they never made it. Do we have any of their works?
They were not painters on canvas. Oh. They did more civic jobs where they would paint the heraldic arms on buildings or on banners, things like this. But they were in the same artist guild that Vermeer was in. So that is a connection.
Van Leeuwenhoek was an apprentice draper in Amsterdam, then returned to Delft and opened his own shop. And that's what really paid the way for a time until he got his city job?
Yes, he worked as a draper. We have a few receipts in his hand, not that many. I think there are two. And somehow during that period when he was working as a draper, he started making lenses and fitting them into his special microscopes.
How did he become interested in science and specifically the microscope?
That's a wonderful question. I think it was the milieu around him. There were lenses everywhere. Artists were using lenses to examine little insects and paint these very fine miniatures of them. They were looking at flowers and painting those wonderful flower paintings that we think of as being so Dutch today. But even people, just everyday people, were buying what were called flea glasses that were essentially magnifying glasses and using them to look at the little cheese mites on the rind of their howdahs. So the idea that you could use lenses to look around you was very common. And then, of course, as a draper, Leeuwenhoek was using a magnifying glass to examine the thread count of fabrics.
It reminded me that Spinoza, the great philosopher, made his living as a lens grinder.
He did. And there is a period of time where he was living a scant 4 miles away from where Leeuwenhoek lived. And I also like to think that the two of them may have known each other. They were both using a very similar kind of lathe at that point to grind and polish lenses. So it's possible Leeuwenhoek learned that from Spinoza.
Leeuwenhoek is credited with improving the microscope. What did he do that was different from his predecessors?
I'm not sure I would say he was improving the microscope. He did make lenses, sometimes by blowing, sometimes by grinding. He probably started out making bead lenses that just melted bits of glass in a fire flame. He set them into these tiny holders that were brass, about an inch wide and 3 inches long. But single lens microscopes like that were very common in the Netherlands at the time. He was quite good at making lenses, and his were very strong. But I think what was so remarkable about Leeuwenhoek and allowed him to make all of the discoveries he did was his incredible patience, that he would return again and again to the same subject, the same specimen, and look at it in different lights and using candlelight or sunlight, using different magnifications of the microscope. And he was able to see what no one else had ever seen.
I would imagine a breakthrough was when he put a drop of water in the microscope. What had Do we know what he expected to see?
You know, this was water from a nearby inland lake that got very murky in the winter with a kind of a greenish algae, I guess we would say. And he was at that point examining everything around him, and he probably thought he would see something green, something that explained the color of the water. But instead, he saw tiny little moving and self-moving particles, and he realized quite out of the blue that he had seen life forms that were not visible to the naked eye.
Was he the first person to ever see microorganisms?
He was. And you could only imagine how both thrilling and kind of unsettling that would have been to him at the time.
How was that viewed by the scientific community? Were they even aware that he had done this?
Eventually, he started writing letters to the Royal Society of London, which was the major scientific organization of the day, and they would receive correspondence from natural scientists all around the world. And Leeuwenhoek was encouraged to write to them by a fellow natural philosopher in Delft, Rainier de Graaf, and he started writing letters to the Royal Society about his observations. The Royal Society, in return, would ask him, why don't you observe blood? Why don't you observe the semen, actually, they suggested to him. And so when he saw these microorganisms, he wrote a letter to the Royal Society.
So he was the first person to see sperm wiggling around?
He was. That was a little later. He was not the first person to see sperm. He was the first person to see the tails of the sperm, and he was the first person to realize that they were not a result of illness, but rather were just natural and part of the human body. And in fact, that they existed in other animals and insects, cockroaches, aphids, all sorts of odd beings.
My guest is Laura J. Snyder, who writes about science and ideas for the Wall Street Journal. She's a professor at St. John's University. And her book that we are discussing is Eye of the Beholder, Johannes Vermeer, Antonie van Leeuwenhoek, and the Reinvention of Seeing. It's published by Norton. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are talking with historian philosopher Laura J. Snyder about her book called The Eye of the Beholder, Johannes Vermeer, Antonie van Leeuwenhoek, and The Reinvention of Seeing. It's published by Norton. We've been talking about van Leeuwenhoek and lenses. Wasn't Vermeer also becoming interested in optical devices of a different sort at the same time, or at least some people think he was?
I think he was. Many of the artists of the time were using lenses. As I mentioned, the miniaturist painters were using magnifying glasses to examine little creatures and flowers. Garrett Dow was famously using a big concave lens in a frame, and he would have to wait till all the dust settled before he could begin to paint because it would pick up so much. And for sure, Vermeer started using lenses, mirrors, and probably a camera obscura as well.
Was this a common practice for Dutch painters of the time? Were any of his great Dutch contemporaries, Rembrandt, Hals, Jan Steen, Kort, also using camera obscura?
Probably so. We don't have absolute evidence where somebody said, and now I'm using my camera obscura to use this painting. Our evidence is the paintings themselves. We know there was a Dutch painter, Gaspar van Vittel, who went to Italy to map the Tiber River and then changed his name to Gaspare van Vitelli and was using a camera obscura to paint Roman cityscapes.
Well, there were rooms in Italy that were called camera lucida, I think, and camera obscura, where you would go in and you would see the scene outside on the wall behind you.
Yes. For centuries, natural philosophers had been using a camera obscura, that is a dark room with a tiny opening to the outside, through which light would pass and project an inverted image of what was outside. And natural philosophers were using them since at least the 15th century to observe solar eclipses. And we know that many writers about art were suggesting put a lens in that hole, and you could use it to project an image that would be bright enough that you could then trace over or paint over.
It would come in upside down.
That's right. Eventually, little box-type cameras were created that would have a mirror that could revert the image so it would not be upside down. And those were, in fact, what were used by Henry Fox Talbot in the 19th century to invent photography.
In fact, it gives you a very much like a photographic image if you use this, as opposed to what artists had done until then, which is just to look. And many artists still do direct looking at the their subject and then painting it on the canvas. Vermeer's work does have the feeling, on to some degree, of a photographic two-dimensionality, different than even what Rembrandt's two-dimensionality looks like.
Yes, in some ways there are definitely aspects of looking through a lens that suddenly appear in Vermeer's works around the 1660s. For one thing, he became quite adept at representing proper perspective, three-dimensional space put onto a two-dimensional image, where he had been having trouble with that before.
But didn't artists like Durer imply a mechanical device to help them get the perspective correct?
Yes, there were many mechanical devices, mirrors and lenses. This was all part of the empirical age that it was.
Mostly in Delft or everywhere?
Especially in the Dutch Republic. You know, the Dutch were very practical people. They had to invent things. Their land was basically underwater, so they had to invent dikes and levees and all sorts of other pumps just in order to stay afloat, basically. And that kind of sensibility informed the way they did science. They were very practical with their science and art as well.
Now, Vermeer went into relative obscurity for about 200 years after he died, although he had been well-known, or kind of well-known, during his lifetime. Rediscovered, do you think, because people started understanding, being able to read his paintings because they had seen photographs?
Perhaps so. In the 19th century, right around the dawn of photography, he was rediscovered as being such a brilliant painter. You know, I think styles change. In the 17th century, in the Dutch Republic, many people were looking through lenses, artists, scientists, the people with their flea glasses. So they were used to seeing a kind of an image through a lens. But then after that, it started looking strange. And you have people writing in the 18th century about how the look of a painting done with a camera obscura is strange, is very unusual.
Well, it's hard to imagine anyone not seeing genius when they look at a Vermeer, but I guess for 200 years they didn't. His women were the subject of most of his paintings, but you cite two, the astronomer and the geographer, that would suggest that Van Leeuwenhoek might have even been an inspiration, even the model?
Some people say Leeuwenhoek was the model. Others say Leeuwenhoek looked nothing like the model used for these two wonderful paintings. I feel that there are many connections that suggest Leeuwenhoek was an inspiration for Vermeer. These are the only two paintings of men, single men, that we have in Vermeer's works. They're both men of science, and they're both men who are engaged in observational sciences. The geographer is really about surveying, and surveyors were using a kind of camera obscura. The other connection is, and of course the astronomer uses a telescope, but one other connection is the geographer is one of the few paintings that Vermeer himself dated, and it was dated 1669, which happens to be the year that Leeuwenhoek passed his exam to be a surveyor in the town of Delft. So that is very suggestive to me.
Well, we talked about how Vermeer was popular and then less so, and then, of course, now considered one of the greatest artists that ever lived. What about Van Leeuwenhoek? Was he recognized in his lifetime as somebody who'd done something important?
He was. By the end of his life, people were coming in droves to visit him. He at one point had to require that people bring a letter of introduction for him to admit them and talk to them. And one day he had 26 visitors, all of whom had the letter of recommendation, except a duke and a count, and he let them in just because they were nobility. And in fact, Peter the Great came to visit him and spent 2 hours talking to him about his microscopic observations.
Now, Vermeer died young and produced only a few works, 47 or something like
that? That's what art historians think.
On the other hand, van Leeuwenhoek lived to be 90. How did he spend his later years? Did he continue doing his research?
He was doing research up until his deathbed.
But he never wrote a book.
No, he never did. He wrote letters to the Royal Society. And I think there are a few reasons for that. One, you get the sense reading his letters that he was doing so many observations and he wasn't willing to stop and take the time it took to write a book. And he kept referring to him as just an observer, not a theoretician, and he just liked to set down on paper the observations as he made them.
Your book includes some 60 pages of notes, cites hundreds of sources, but yet we know so little about these men. Did you expect to discover more when you started, that they had been best friends?
Well, I hope to find a direct connection or direct evidence of a connection between them. But we do have a lot. For Leeuwenhoek, we have 16, I think it is now, volumes of his letters to the Royal Society. And you could go to the New York Public Library and ask for them and read hundreds and hundreds of letters. And you really do get a sense of his personality about how he felt sad when his dog died and he was so proud of its beautiful long hair and how he wore glasses. And for Vermeer, we have the paintings. And the paintings are the documents we have about Vermeer and his thoughts and his life.
But when he died, leaving 11 children, the art market had kind of fallen. And he didn't leave very much money.
No, it was quite a bad situation. 1672 was the year of catastrophe for the Dutch. They were invaded. They called it the Rampjaar, and the art market fell apart. And when Vermeer died, his family was really destitute, and Leeuwenhoek had to come in. He organized an auction of his remaining paintings.
Laura Snyder will be giving a reading and signing books at the Corner Bookstore tonight at 6 o'clock. That's at 93rd Street and Madison Avenue. Her book, Eye of the Beholder, Johannes Vermeer and Antoni van Leeuwenhoek and the Reinvention of Seeing, is published by Norton. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.